Machete Mate recognizes the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and any indigenous elders of other communities who may be listening today. We stand in solidarity in their struggle towards the colonization and land back. Buenas, mi gente. What is good? Machete Mate. Comrade Conversation today. A comrade conversation, long time in the making, so really excited for this one. Shout out to the new compas oficiales, Jason Tyler, and friend of the show, Comrade Kenzo Shibata. Austin has been on his stream / podcast, Class Time Pod, before. Kenzo's a teacher, a union militant in Chicago, doing great work, so check him out at Kenzo Shibata Show, Class Time, and Meet the Left. Super good dude, so support his work as well. Speaking of Austin and our patrons, if you haven't already, check out our patron exclusive episode where Austin details his incredible experience in Venezuela. It's a two-parter, and we'll be releasing the second part soon-ish, probably with this one. We'll see how we go. So if you want to hear the behind-the-scenes spiciness of the DSA Brigade in Venezuela, or just generally want to support what we do, consider showing us some solidarity on our Patreon. Anyway, I'm Leroy in Wurundjeri country in so-called Melbourne, Australia, with the homie T. What's good, T?
What's up, y'all? How's it going?
Yep. And of course, the man himself, Austin. What's good, man?
What up? What up? I am officially back from my meeting with the Red Pope. Yes, I met the Red Pope. I fist bumped him. I looked him in his eyes.
he's been planning that joke for a while now. So he got it out. Congratulations. Also,
thank you.
But yeah, like I said, we are joined today by special guest, special comrade, Fern. Irmão, bem-vindo a nosso podcast. Un placer para nos. ¿Cómo va, camarada?
Oi, tudo bom? I'm glad to be here, guys. Thank you. Thank you for the invite.
No, always is, like I said, it was our pleasure. Definitely our pleasure to have you on. But before we actually get into it, just a quick vibe check just to see how we're all doing. Fern, you're the guest. You go first. How's your day been? What's new? How are you feeling? Like, what's good, man?
It was good. It was good. I've been busy at work, busy with DSA, which is always good. It's been good. I can't complain. Excited about the DSA convention. Excited about the work that we've been doing the DSA International Committee. And it's been a good, busy but good couple of weeks.
Fantastic. It's good to hear. T, you go. What's good, man? If you like, obviously you can't see him, but he's about to like pass out here.
Well, yeah, it's been a long couple weeks because of work. But yeah, today, I will say this: I am in a better mood. As in, today is probably the first day in the last couple weeks where I think I can actually do this job that I was just promoted to, which is nice. So that's good.
That's good. Austin, what's good, man?
All things are very good. I must say. Similarly to as Fern described, my goodness, DSA stuff has been quite time-consuming these days. But I am looking forward to our national convention, right? I am looking forward to be done with our national convention, I will say it, right? Moving forward and actually getting back to work with some of the amazing projects we've got going on in the International Committee and through the national organization. So that's super cool. I'm also glad to hear that you are beginning to have the batteries refreshed there, T. I remember when we recorded our Patreon episode over the weekend, you both looked like death. I'm going to keep it real right now. You both looked like you were like, oh, shit, this is like, I don't want to fucking be here. So that's good to see.
Once you hit a certain age.
I was about to say, which brings me to you, Leroy. How are you doing, my friend?
Yeah, I'm doing better. Last couple of days, I've been sort of feeling under the weather, had a sore throat. So I missed work yesterday to get COVID tested. Came back negative, which is good. But yeah, I've been chilling. Yay. Planted some garlic somewhere the other day, which obviously immediately triggered my anxiety because obviously I did everything wrong. The weather's shit. Is the weather good? This and that, whatever, blah, 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 blah. If you plant shit, you know what I'm talking about. No real complaints except for the weather's cold, and y'all know I'm famous for hating cold weather, so there's that. But nah, living the dream, like I was telling you, Austin, just, you know, have access to the discourse, but I'm completely away from it. So all good. Anyway, we'll go into it. So obviously we have Fern on today to talk a little bit about his background being Brazilian, a bit of the history and politics of Brazil and his experience in the US and all that stuff. But before we get into it, just a couple of headlines, because obviously there's been a lot of things going on in the region, a lot of discourse stemming from that. So obviously last week, everything that's going on in Haiti, I don't know if it's tinfoil hat time yet, or we save that for when we actually do a proper current events episode, but obviously Jovenel Moise was assassinated and things are coming out, like mercenaries are coming out who have direct links to like the US State Department, all that stuff. Pretty wild. What do you guys reckon about that? Austin, what do you think, man?
Oh man. Like it's when the story first came out, right, and I think we should preface this with saying, you know, over the weekend, hopefully we'll have time to really like delve deep into this story and some of these other stories a little bit deeper. But like when this story first came out, like I had so many thoughts rushing through my head, right? Obviously the prevailing thought is there's no way like a head of state gets assassinated in this hemisphere without like Southcom or like the CIA like knowing or something like that, right? And yeah. At the same time, like, I feel like Jovenel Moise, like, pissed off so many people in Haiti. Like, I could just as easily see, like, the billionaire class in Haiti just saying, let's hire some Colombian paramilitaries and get this, and just eliminate this fucking guy. Right? Like, it could have been from anywhere. But, like, I think fundamentally what people have kind of, like, the idea that people have kind of coalesced around within Haiti, which I just totally understandable, is that, you know, we hated this motherfucker, right? We wanted to get this guy out, but this was not the way, right? Having far right paramilitaries storm his house in the middle of the night and like what, pump like 12 rounds in him? Jesus Christ, right? Like this is once again just in another tale in the offensive, you know, treatment of Haitian ignoring of Haitian sovereignty, right? Just treating Haiti like you know, who gives a fuck? Their president. Let's just, you know, get rid of him. Who's gonna care, right? So, you know, my heart, you know, as a fellow Caribbean, right, or whatever we want to call it, like my heart will always be with Haiti and the Haitian Revolution, and it's so important to once again just be listening to what the Haitians are saying and like amplifying their voices and listening to what the people on the ground are going through and trying to push for Haiti, right? Because this is a very complicated situation. This is a very complex situation. I think a lot of details still are yet to come out, but yeah, we'll see. And once again, maybe we'll dive a bit deeper over the weekend.
Yeah, just quickly, 1,000% on that. Like because of just the nature of the history of Haiti, who knows what happened? It could have been, like you said, just the billionaire class who, I mean, at the end of the day, ostensibly have connections to the US and all that stuff, deciding, you know, he's becoming too inconvenient for us. People are in the streets. Why don't we get rid of him, put someone else in, and hopefully pacify the people? Or it was legit the US State Department, the CIA going in there. Or it could be a thousand other things. It could be 1,000 other things. But I think at the end of the day, the most important thing about this is being in solidarity and supporting the actual people who initially war against Moise.
Absolutely, man. And like, it's amazing. This protest movement in Haiti, you know, was going on for years against Moise, right? So like, once again, there's a lot of complexities here. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, the State Department potentially being involved. It's impossible to look past the CIA director being in South America literally a week before, right? Meeting with Bolsonaro, who we'll be talking about later in this episode, I'm sure. And it's especially relevant to another one of the stories you want to talk about, which I guess I'll pass back over to you, Leroy.
Yeah, I think, and you're talking about Cuba, because obviously right now the hot topic is what's going on in Cuba. And again, another complex situation, protests in the streets. And from what I'm seeing, it like Cuba's definitely always going to be that place that a lot of us on the left, a lot of us self-proclaimed communists, are always going to look at as like sort of like the, I don't want to say like the model, the ideal, but sort of that place we always look at like a successful revolution in action. But in saying that, if we are going to be proper, and I hate to say principled Marxists, we have to look at, you know, the issues that are prevalent in the government and in the society. And we can't sit here and say that there's nothing, that everything's perfect. But again, there's a lot of there's too many moving parts here. There's a lot of things that are fishy, a lot of complexities here. And I don't want to speak on behalf of the people there or over people who actually know more than we do.
I think something else to remember is that even more so than Haiti, the information coming out of Cuba is even murkier. There's just not a lot coming out, at least that we can get a hold of in the United States in terms of information about what's going on there. So I think it's one of those things to really just kind of wait and see. If there's one thing though, that I think, and no doubt we're going to go into this, later this week, on a longer current events episode. But if there's one thing that people in the United States, especially I understand people like not taking a side, quote unquote, or whatever. But if there's one thing we can be firm on is to end the sanctions, right? Yes. That is, I think, the one thing that we can all, that everybody can agree on. As you said, Leroy, to stand in solidarity with people with legitimate grievances, of course, that goes without saying. At the same time, recognizing, the complexities everywhere.
Yeah, no, totally. And like, I think, once again, just like you just said there, T, like, I think any conversation in the United States regarding Cuba has to begin and end with ending the blockade, right? I think we have a duty as leftists in the United States to recognize that, once again, we're in the Imperial Corps. We live with the war machine in our backyard, right? We need to end the goddamn blockade. We need to end the embargo, right? And I think that's critically important. I think talking about the nature of the protests in Cuba as well, I think in my mind, what we're seeing is a very cynical manipulation by the United States and by the Miami industrial complex of perhaps some legitimate discontent with, pandemic response, which has been seen the world over, right? So it's, once again, it's especially jarring when you compare the response between U.S. media regarding these, protests in Cuba or the protests in Haiti, right, which were genuinely mass protests over years and completely ignored. Even when we look at Guatemala, which I don't know, maybe we can briefly touch upon here, right? There's been major protests in Guatemala about the very bad pandemic response for the Jemetei government, right? Is U.S. media talking about that? Hell no, right? Because that's a right-wing government. The U.S. loves the president of Guatemala. So for them, for the Guatemalans, they don't matter to the Miami industrial complex. They don't matter to U.S. media. But this attempt to try and squeeze the Cuban government, which once again, very conveniently, just a week after the CIA director is in South America, has certainly got me raising my eyebrow, right? But everybody knows I love the Cuban revolution, and we'll continue to support the Cuban government.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. I think this is one of the places where we might have, I don't want to say disagreements, but maybe differences of emphasis, maybe. I think it's, I don't think there's anything wrong. Like, at the end of the day, fundamentally, we are with the working class and oppressed peoples, whatever it may be, the ultimate goal is, like you said, when you went to Venezuela, you got to see the withering away of the state in real time. That's one of the aims, and that's one of the goals. And I don't think there's a contradiction between having, admiration and love for the Cuban Revolution, and as well as saying strongly critical of especially the United States and our truly brutal sanctions that are that honestly inflict far more suffering on the island than anything else.
Yeah, my thing always, and I think I mentioned it with Venezuela as well, when we did the thing that if communism is so bad, if socialism is so bad, if like the government's so repressive, and they're using the blockade as an excuse, get rid of blockade. Let it fail on its own merits. Let it fail on its own merits.
Exactly.
Let's see. But they won't, because they know, because the entire propaganda, the entire, policy towards Cuba is dependent on making the economy scream, like Kissinger said about Chile with the Chicago Boys and all that. So, it's all bullshit.
Absolutely. And now we're drifting off into another direction entirely, but I just feel compelled to say this, right? Which is like, when it comes to Venezuela, right, a lot of people talk about, oh, yeah, you see, they've got oil, so the United States is trying to sabotage them and steal the oil. Obviously, that's an aspect of it, right? But the United States has oil, right? The United States has partners to get oil from. It's about destroying the project, right? It's about destroying the example that Venezuela has provided to the world. That's what the United States is invested in when it comes to strangling, when it comes to strangling Venezuela. But once again, we're getting into another direction entirely, and hopefully over the weekend, we can maybe dive into these stories in particular a bit deeper. Yeah, back to you, Leroy.
Yeah, 100%. And again, we probably did same mistake. We didn't talk about Puerto Rico, but we talked about things that are near and dear to our hearts. So it tends to drag on. But anyway, we'll get into it. So obviously, we, like I said, Fern's joined us today. Talk a little bit about himself, about Brazil, about what I probably consider the most important power in the region. A lot of people might like to talk about Mexico or whatever, but I think in terms of like the right-wing presence in Latin America, I think the center of that is Brazil. The way Brazil goes, the rest of the region goes. It just came out recently, I think, that they had their hand very much in a honeypot in the Bolivian coup not too long ago that we talked about a lot about. But again, Farron, welcome to the show. And I think before we get into it, like, one question I always like to ask the guests is basically talk about like where they're from and stuff. So you're from Brazil. Like, in your estimation, what is Brazil beyond, like, you know, it's a Portuguese-speaking country. Like, when you're there, what are the people like? What's the smell like? What is that, like, sort of nostalgic feeling that you feel? Like, paint a picture for us.
So I left Brazil when I was 12. So that's been some 20-something years ago. But I was fortunate enough to grow up on a big Brazilian community here in New Jersey. So I had a little bit of home here. So, I mean, the people being able to, like, going to the restaurants, walking out, like, the neighborhood that I grew up here in New Jersey, if you speak English, everybody looked at you weird, like, well, where that guy from? Everybody speaks Portuguese on the street, so we have like Brazilian style bars, Brazilian style restaurants. My mom was a cook in a Brazilian restaurant here, so it was like home. I mean, not 100%, but was so I feel myself fortunate to have grown up in a place like that. I think that what we usually say in Brazil is that the best of Brazil is the Brazilians. So yeah, now growing around having Brazilian friends growing up and all that was absolutely a privilege. And but then again, I grew up in this town, so I was very sheltered to what America really was, and I got to experience that a little bit when I was like 17. I went to work, and then that's when like the real like America hit, like the United States hit me to what it was.
Were you always kind of like politically inclined or like politically active, or was there any like moment in your life where you like started kind of like getting more active, or any moment that might have even sort of like inspired you? You know, you describe, you know, getting older and kind of realizing what America really was. And I think that's an experience that a lot of us, like, whether in the diaspora or from countries in Latin America, that's a moment a lot of us have, right? Where we realize what America really is, right? Once again, like, was there any moment for you where you really started to become politically active?
So for me, I think like politics always found a way to hit me somehow. So I remember as a kid in Brazil, my very first political experience. So I was like 6-7 years old, and PT had a rally right at my street. Like, it was a candidate for PT, the Workers' Party. He had this rally. He was running for like city council or something. He had this rally right in front of my house. So that was the very first like political experience I ever had in my life. But I mean, I was a kid. I remember another big moment that this is something that I always remember. My father is not political involved or anything like that, but he was. So as we were talking, like, we used to spend weekends together talking about soccer, talking about things. And one day we were talking about politics for some reason. And I was like a 10-year-old kid, and we were talking about the Brazilian dictatorship, and he was trying to explain to me what communism was or what socialism was. So his explanation to me was, communism is a government that it's common for everyone. It's for everyone. And that stuck to me a lot. I think that was sort of like the spark, because from there I got really curious to know about how it was during the dictatorship, and by looking for it, that's how I got to find out that socialists played a large part to the end of the Brazilian dictatorship. People fought, a lot of people died. There was a lot of tortures, a lot of comrades. Was a difficult time, but it was courageous people that, like, working class people, students that really went out there and fought. So I think that was the beginning of my political awakening. But as far as I got involved, it was also in Brazil. So I came to the United States. I went back to Brazil briefly and for 6 months. And while I was there, I was attending school. It was my sophomore year in high school. And my school it was a state-run school. And the school looked like a jail. Like, the infrastructure was horrible. Like, the building was falling apart. But the school itself was really good, really good teachers, but very neglected by the state. And that was the year that Lula was elected. Lula was elected like a month when I was on that school. And they had a very like neoliberal governor that was running. The school was run by government state funds. And the school, so this school had a chapter of the High School Students Union, which is a large high school students union in Brazil. They represent close to 40 million students all over the country. So they had a chapter there. And they did a protest for school supplies, because the state was required by law to give it to schools, but they were not giving it. And the city that I was born, Belo Horizonte, was the only major city in Brazil at the time that students had to pay the whole bus fare to go to school. All the other major cities, students could only pay half. So they tried to do that so kids, you know, like, have ways to go to school. So we did this protest. So it was like 6 months. People were organizing. I was just like a brink and fire person of the organization at the time. I didn't help running anything, but was my very first political moment. And it was the moment too that I noticed how the oligarchies and the capitalist system, they're not gonna give anything to us easily. Because as we went to downtown Belo Horizonte for this protest, over 30-something schools, students for over 30-something schools all went together for that, and the cops were there shooting, like, rubber bullets and hitting, like, 15-year-olds, 14-year-olds.
Jesus. So wow.
That's when I really noticed that like, the fight, the struggle, it's not going to be easy, but it's the one that we have to fight.
That's fucking amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible. And just want to go back to something you said, because I guess my experience in the U.S. is very similar to yours. Like, obviously, I'm Puerto Rican. I grew up in Kissimmee, which is little Puerto Rico. So everyone around me was Puerto Rican, or at least from somewhere in Latin America. Everyone spoke Spanish to a certain degree. And it wasn't really until I went to college, when I was outside of that bubble, where I'm like, I'm different. You know what? I'm like, I look different. Like, my mannerisms are different. Like, and it's very interesting, because obviously, like, quote, like, we're in their country, but because you grow up in that little bubble, it's like, why are they weird? You know what I mean? And then you realize that everyone else around you is the same and you're different. It's quite an quite a culture shock, like 20 years into your life. You know what I mean? So definitely feel that. So you had that protest in Brazil. You spent the 6 months in, you know, organizing with, I guess, with the PT and the student union or whatever. And then you come back to the US. How were you different? How did that change you, I guess, quote, as an American when you came back? Did that influence you to be more politically involved, or were you like still nothing like was available to you, or how did you change?
When I came back, at the time it was tough. So because when I came back, I think that, and I think that's true for a lot of us. Like when we talk about politics, a lot of people think about electoral politics, right? And what everybody knows here is like it's either the Democrats or the Republicans. So when I came back, we feel constrained to this duality, right? That a lot of people feel constrained at. Yeah. So I came, I would say that what really, so I mean, I came back, I went back to school. I was just living my normal life. I actually never finished high school. I came to get my GED later on because I went to live alone when I was 17, so I need to work. So I dropped out of high school to go to work. That's how I got into construction. So I've been in the construction business for 18 years. And I think that really, that was a wake-up call for me. Because again, it was the first time that I was leaving my Brazilian community, like going to job sites all over the state of New Jersey, New York, Connecticut. And what was difficult, I mean, seeing what workers go through, what a lot of immigrant workers go through. I've been through a lot of, I would say like prejudices, exploitation, being a Latino sometimes in a field that is very dominant by white people, it's difficult. So that was difficult for me at the beginning. The exploitation, it's something that it's on the construction business, it's insane. So that was a wake up call for me. It took me a really long time to try to be active. I was for years just trying to survive, you know, living paycheck by paycheck. I was a father very young, so when I was 20 years old, I already had a kid. So that was my priority. Try to make the rent, be able to support my daughter. So that was my two big focuses. And so I was for many years with like not political involved. I used to follow a lot. I was always on the internet, and I was always more interested in Brazilian politics because I felt that American politics was not for me. I felt that the Republican Party, the Democratic Party was not for me, was not for immigrants, mm-hmm. you know, because we see they talking about immigration reform and this and that, make America more equal for immigrants. And year after year, everything was the same. So I felt that immigrants did not have a place in the American politics. So I was very interested in Brazilian politics. I always follow, always a PT supporter. And it's funny that I think that the day that I noticed that I could do something was when Trump won the election. I think that was also another wake-up call that a lot of us had. I developed my career as a construction worker. I came to be a construction supervisor, a safety manager, but I was actually working on a pharmaceutical plant. Those that like it's one of the that exploits the most out of workers, right? The pharmaceutical industry. I was working on a pharmaceutical plant, wow. And I was on my coffee break, 9 o'clock in the morning. And that was the day that I went on my computer and I joined DSA because I noticed that I had to do something.
Yo, that's extremely amazing. And I just have to say as well, like, this is why I love you, buddy, right? This is why I love you and I love your story, right? An actual person from the working class, an actual Latino organizer from the working class, right? This is what this podcast is all about, right? This is what I think DSA and the socialist movement in the United States should be all about, right? Leaders such as yourselves, like taking agency in your life, you know, using the experiences you've learned, like you said, from being a construction worker for almost your whole life. Like, I love you. I know you've in the past described to me like the different values like that has instilled in you, like as far as like teamwork and like collective identity and stuff like that. Which once again, that's beautiful. But I'll pass it over to you, Leroy. You about to ask something?
Yeah. No. Just quickly on that point as well, that the fact that work is a very real, tangible thing, and not just this sort of philosophical, abstract notion of quote work that a lot of like armchair quote Marxists or communists or socialists talk about. Like, this is a story of doing actual work, actual organizing, actual exploitation, actual immigration, actual, you know, lived experiences, you know, not to use the cliche hot phrase at the moment, but yeah, that's it's quite incredible. So you joined DSA, but you're still sort of involved with PT. What's the, I guess, I don't want to say reconcile, because I mean they're two different things, but what is your role in either? Because obviously you're running for, you know, MPC and DSA. What is your involvement specifically with PT?
So for many years I was always just a supporter. I was a supporter of PT. I voted here in the Brazilian elections. So I was always, first of all, just a big supporter of PT. And like we said in Brazil, like PT has, I believe, 1.5 million members, registered members. But we usually say that it's close to 50 petistas, because that's the mass, right? What we consider members of the party is those that support the party, vote for the party, goes to the rallies. So I've always considered myself a petista. I think that the party changed Brazil immensely. It wasn't perfect, and we have to recognize that it wasn't perfect. There's always that, like, that taste in our mouth that could have been better, but it was a movement that really brought a lot of good things for Brazil. So I actually started to get more involved more recently. I'm still working on getting my member, like, to become really a member of PT, because the process is not as simple as just join DSA, like through a website. You have to go through, it's a more complex process. But I think that the goal, my goal right now, besides all the work that I do in DSA, which is things that I'm living here in the United States, but I think that the big goal is going to be next year's election. I think that I'm getting together with all the comrades who are petistas as well, and supporters, who I think the big task for us is taking Bolsonaro out of government. And I think it's going to take all of us to be out there organizing, because we have to bring Lula back to the presidency.
Yo, I guess we're like, I'm totally like getting like all over the script here or whatever the hell, but like, because we're already talking about this right now, I wonder if you want to talk a little bit more, like, so correct me if I'm wrong, you've been involved with like solidarity protests and putting solidarity protests together in the United States, right? As far as like for Bolsonaro protests. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that or some of the actions that you've done recently. I feel like I saw like some pictures or something, unless I'm like mistaking. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, you're right. So that was two Saturdays ago. So in New York, there's this group, that there are many groups of Brazilian organizers in New York City, right? That they do a lot of pro-democracy work, a lot of pro-Lula work, anti-Bolsonaro work. But in the city that I grew up, which is Newark, New Jersey, the big Brazilian community there, unfortunately, it's a very conservative community. Bolsonaro had has a large support base over there. So It was us. So we just did our first. So two Saturdays ago, we did our first Stop Bolsonaro action in Newark. We were a bit worried about it because we didn't know how people would accept it, right? Because not too long ago, we would see Bolsonaro flags and stickers all over the place. But it was actually quite the opposite of what we were expecting. A lot of people stopped to talk to us. A lot of people supported it because I feel that the people are seeing what's going on. We had over 500,000 deaths in Brazil from COVID, purely because of Bolsonaro's neglect of the pandemic. And right now we are finding out through investigation that it seems like that he was taking kickbacks for the vaccines. So that was a big reason. So, I mean, corruption to the core. He's trying to sell out the country, selling all of our state-owned, government-owned companies, especially in the energy industry, selling out for peanuts for the private interests. I mean, the country's in shambles, unemployment to the roof, people are really struggling. So I'm glad that the Brazilians here are understanding that this is not the kind of leader that we need. It's not the kind of leader that the Brazilian workers need.
Yeah, I think on that note, if you can, for anyone listening to us here, can you just give maybe a little bit of a historical context on politics in Brazil? Like you mentioned the dictatorship, maybe a little bit about how that came about, what Brazil was like under the dictatorship. Obviously, it probably ended when you were still really, really young. But just like from what you know since then, and maybe a little bit about like the actual political system as it stands now, parties and all that, just to give us a little bit of context so we know exactly what we're talking about.
So we had in the 1960s, was politics in Brazil from since the end of the colonial era up to the 60s was pretty much ran by oligarchies. So the rich, the powerful was the one that controlled the politics in Brazil. Until in the 60s, we had a president called João Goulart. He was the first one who really wanted it to propose land reforms, educational reforms. He really wanted it to govern for the people. So that was in 1964. So that's when we suffered a military coup because they could not let that happen, right? They could not let the Brazilian workers be taken care of it for once. So we lived over, it was close to 30 years of a military dictatorship. Ended in the late 80s, early 90s. We had, I think, four or five military generals who were the dictators. Extremely, was brutal. Was a brutal dictatorship. A lot of people died. A lot of people were tortured. If you were a leftist, you had a target on your head, pretty much. So it was tough times. That's when my parents grew up around the dictatorship. Listen to the stories, it's horrible. So the end of the early 90s, we had our first democratically elected president. He was a neoliberal that was elected with the support of the media. Actually, the big media helped him out because they knew for sure that Lula had a shot on winning the election. So this guy, his name is Fernando Collor, he won. He was actually impeached because of he wasn't a good leader. So he was impeached. We had his vice president. His vice president was in power. We had another election, another neoliberal won. And again, these people, when it was all doing they are not governing for the people. They are governing for the oligarchies. They were governing for the United States. The United States was pretty much going to Brazil and taking everything, right? We are all of our natural resources. Again, was the privatization of a lot of the government-owned companies. And that was around the time that I came. My family decided to come to the United States because my parents, we just couldn't it was getting impossible to live, right? My father used to work on a car dealership, and he lost his job. He couldn't get another job. So it was difficult. It was difficult times. And then 2002 came, Lula won the election after losing two or three other elections. So when he won, I think that a lot of people it changed the life of a lot of people. I have family members, people from the neighborhood that I grew up in Brazil. I think the PT's government changed a lot with the safety nets. Lula was a president who opened up the more technical schools, colleges. It was the first time that you see someone from the barrios, from the favelas, being able to attend a college, getting a college degree. So people buying their first homes. I think Lula did this program that people could buy affordable homes. So a lot of people were buying their first homes during his government. So it changed the life of a lot of people. He left the presidency with over 80% approval ratings, which is the highest ever. So his successor was Dilma Rousseff, which she was also a member of the Workers' Party. And I think that's when things start to get really bad. I think was a little bit of the economical crisis that was hitting the whole world, but was also a little bit of capital strike from the oligarchies in Brazil and the private interests, because they just didn't want a leftist government anymore. And that the right wing parties, it was all came together to really undermine her government. And they got to a point that they really were successful in doing it. She got impeached. Her vice president, which was a member of a center-right party, he gutted the workers' rights. He passed a labor reform that pretty much gutted the workers' rights. And after he finished his term, Bolsonaro came, and that's where we are at now, what we're living through, which is a government with the corruption, it's unemployment, and the workers are really mistreated there now.
Yo, I gotta ask. And first of all, thank you for that. That is so. I'm a nerd, right? This shit is so interesting to me. Were you surprised to see somebody like Bolsonaro win the presidency in Brazil? Did it take you by surprise to see somebody so far right wing using that sort of rhetoric? Or once again, was this something you expected after like the Lawfare and the campaign and Lava Jato, right? The campaigns to take down the PT. Once again, what was your reaction to see somebody like Bolsonaro taking power?
I wasn't as surprised, because to me it felt like I was seeing this again. I think that it really felt to me the same as when Trump won the election here. So I just felt like I was watching the same movie again. I think what happened was the Brazilian working class, they felt helpless. I think Dilma left, the big media constantly attacking the Workers' Party and leftist politicians. So I think that the working class felt really helpless. And then came this guy saying that he was going to be zero tolerance with corruption, with violence. And I think a lot of people bought that. And was a lot of people who really wanted it better times. So unfortunately, he was able, he appealed a lot to religion as well. So it was,
yeah.
He appealed to a base that was feeling abandoned, right? Like without a base, without something to hold to. And unfortunately, he came to power and he betrayed the workers big time.
Yeah, and I think one of the big lessons here, especially in Brazil, is how stratified society is. Like just going pre-dictatorship, you mentioned that it was basically the oligarchies running the show. Like knowing what little I know about Brazilian history, if you left them to their own devices, the good old boys from the late 1800s, early 1900s, post-colonial Brazil, they'd be running massive plantations if they were allowed to, right? It'd be like old boys, like these rich white dudes running everything, but obviously they're part of this global order, so they can't do it. Another thing to take away is, and we see this all across Latin America, you have one guy coming in proposing even mild reforms. Maybe some of this land should go to the people. Maybe some of these profits, maybe just a little bit of these profits should go to the people. U.S. capital, global capital will not support that. You know, the prevailing system cannot support that, which is why we see military dictatorship. We saw it with Gaitan in Colombia. We see it all across Latin America. But I think one thing that really shocked me, because I think like you, when Bolsonaro came to power, obviously like I was shocked. I was sad. I was, you know, it affected me deeply as well. But I wasn't surprised necessarily. But what did shock me was they would interview people in the streets and they're saying, oh, we need to go back to the dictatorship. That's when those were the good old times under the dictatorship. And I'm like, are you like, and I think that's what made it clear to me the actual social stratification of society. Like, can you just speak on that, on the people like begging for the dictatorship back?
And again, I think it was something that really surprised me as well. I mean, the dictatorship was, I don't think we had any good lessons from it. Again, it's proven visually that it was corrupt. It was, the lack of rights was insane. Censorship, the military, they mess up. They had their hands on everything, including soccer. If I'm not mistaken, like this is something, it's unreal. Like the Brazilian soccer team in 1970s, we had the coach, the head coach, was taken away from his job. He was the head coach of the national team in Brazil, and he was taking it away because he was a leftist. And the military dictatorship took him away and put somebody else to be the. So they had absolute control of people's lives and for the worse, and they just repressed people. They repressed workers, especially those trying to fight for their rights. So it's seeing people supporting that, it's just like, to me, especially seeing some like people that comes from more humble like parts of society, that, to me, that was really heartbroken.
Yeah, and I think just to the soccer point, I don't know if anyone's seen the latest documentary on Pele, where it gets to the point where there's a dictatorship, he's taking pictures with the dictators, and they're talking about how like everyone was giving him shit, like, how can you do this? And he's trying to explain, like, you didn't have a choice. Like, if they wanted a picture with you, you're taking a picture with them. Like, there's no way around it. Like, it wasn't a support thing. It was just... I'm the man of the hour. I'm the best player in Brazil. I am going to have to do whatever they tell me if I want to keep being the best player in Brazil.
Yo, no, yeah, that's super duper interesting. And like, since we're getting like 50 minutes here, and I do want to talk to you a little bit about like DSA stuff and a little bit of that before we let you go. One last question I do have about Brazilian politics, because this is such a fascinating topic. It's an important topic, not just to Brazilians, not just to Latin Americans, to the whole world, right? Brazil is a really important country. What do you think of, what is your prediction for the future of Brazil, right? Is Lula going to win? Are the PT going to win? What do you see as far as like preparing for the elections next year in Brazil? Once again, just from your perspective.
I feel hopeful. I think I saw a poll not too long ago where they were asking about people's which party did they identify themselves. PT was the first with 22% of the population feeling that PT represents them. The party that came second had 2%. So I think the PT has an overwhelmed in the country. I think Lula is someone who has seen him speaking now. I mean, now he's clear of all charges. We all seen that he was a victim of warfare. So he's been clear of all charges. He's eligible for to be president again, and I think that he is. Like, as far as a leftist candidate, he is the only one that would be able to beat Bolsonaro. I think that it's extremely important for the other left organizations in Brazil to get behind this candidacy, because I feel that this is the only way for us to get out of Bolsonaro's grasps, right? And the conservatives' grasps and the far right grasp in Brazil. So I feel confident. I feel very, like, from what I'm seeing, even here in the United States within the Brazilian community, I feel hopeful. I think that 2022 will be a really good year politically for the Brazilian working class.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. That's really good to hear. And I mean, I consider my Portuguese to be pretty okay, but like when you hear Lula speak, like, you don't have to understand Portuguese, you feel what he's saying. Like, you feel what he's saying. But just quickly before, again, we move on to the more things that, you know, Austin wants to talk about, can you just say like a few things about some of the other ostensibly leftist parties? Like, there's PT, there's the other leftist parties. Like, can you just say a few things about them and how they figure into, like, it's the mass movements going into the election?
Yeah, so we PSOL is a big left-wing party in Brazil now. They are made of comrades who left PT in 2006. And these are people that left PT because they had disagreements about, if I'm not mistaken, was a pension reform or something like that. So they left the party. PSOL has been an important party in the leftist in the left wing field in Brazil, especially in big cities like Rio and São Paulo, as well as in the South Brazil. So they've been important players in the Brazilian politics. Guilherme Boulos, which is from São Paulo, he ran for São Paulo mayor in these last elections. He is someone that I truly like as a politician. He's an organizer with the homeless workers movement. And I think that he will be, like, he's coming together with this new crop of leftist leaders in Brazil that I think we need. And I'm very excited about what PSOL can also bring to the mix. Again, it's not a party as massive, as immersive within the Brazilian working class SPT, but I think all of us have like a part to play. All organizations, all leftist organizations in Brazil have a part to play. And if I have to say one more, I think it's this organization, to me, it's one that really inspires me as someone involved in politics, which is the Landless Workers Movement in Brazil.
Yeah.
They are a Marxist organization. Again, they have, I think it's 1.5 million members. They organize for land reform in Brazil, which is extremely overdue. And the way that the work, they are one of the biggest, they are one of the biggest, the largest, they make organic food, one of the largest in Latin America. And they do that. It's all artisanal farming. It's all natural. So, I mean, they do an amazing job. Again, extremely prepared, like the police and the government repressed against them a lot. But I think that they are, to me, they are the most inspiring organization in Brazil. I think that the work that they do is amazing. And they have also a really big play, role to play in our politics.
100%. And, you know, I just came back from Venezuela, right? When I was in Venezuela, a lot of people, when they would talk about Brazil, they would talk about the landless workers movement, right? They would talk about how much of an inspiring example they provide, not just to Brazil, but to the entire continent, to the entire region. So they're definitely, they're extremely awesome, to say the least. But once again, you have been very generous with your time with us here today. We're coming up on an hour, but I do want to talk to you a little bit about DSA, right? Just spend a couple minutes here talking about, once again, your DSA story. I love whenever we have DSA members on the podcast, I love to do a live on-air one-on-one. So please, tell us about your chapter, right? How you got involved with your chapter, what brought you to this point where you're running for NPC? Once again, if you could summarize your DSA story, so to speak.
Yes, so I organized with North Jersey DSA. I joined the chapter was mid-2018. And to me, it's been a life-changing experience. When I joined the chapter wasn't as big as it is now. Now we have over 1,000 members.
Hell yeah!
I served in a few positions with them. I was a delegate in 2019. I served as the immigrant justice co-chair for my chapter. I've done a lot of immigrant justice work for the chapter. I served as well in last year, throughout the whole last year, I was the chapter's membership coordinator. So I was the one making phone calls for new members. I believe I did over 600 calls to new members last year alone, welcoming them to the chapter. So to me, it was really rewarding. It was a really rewarding experience. Talking to new members, getting them, welcoming them to the movement. I think this was a great pleasure. Lately, I end up joining. I applied and I end up joining the international committee, which is something I'm very passionate about because I'm passionate about international politics, what's going on. In my country, Brazil, Latin America, the Global South. I think my very first DSA meeting that I ever attend to was an international panel in New York done by the New York City DSA. But other than that, in my chapter, I do a lot. I've been more active in the immigrant justice working group. We have an Abolish ICE campaign going on. Which I'm helping out as a rank and file member of the working group, and we are pushing to abolish ICE in New Jersey. I'm doing this work with like another great, amazing organizers in our chapter. I do a lot of work with language justice because so I translate a lot of the work that we do to Portuguese. To me, that's very important because I want to see people like me join DSA. I want to see other Brazilians join DSA. Yeah. I want to see other Latinos joining DSA, other immigrants. New Jersey, we have a lot of immigrant communities here. We have a lot of Brazilians, Ecuadorian communities, Colombian communities. So I push really hard for language justice. We've been doing good. We have a group of comrades, myself with Portuguese. We have another group of comrades with Spanish translations. So I think that our chapter is moving forward greatly with that. And our chapter, we've been doing a lot of work. We have a really amazing mutual aid group that, especially now through the pandemic, they did a lot of work. I do some language justice for them as well. I believe they distribute over $20,000 worth of groceries for families in need, mostly immigrant families, in the community that I was born, that I grew up in. So that meant a lot to me. So they do an amazing job. So a shout out. It's called the Brick City Mutual Aid. So shout out to them. My chapter has also been doing a lot of good electoral work. We have an electoral working group who is working with a DSA candidate with big chances of winning an election. His name is Joe Brooks. He's running for Jersey City Award B councilman. Again, a socialist housing justice organizer. So I'm very excited to see him doing well. But the chapter grew. I think I grew with the chapter. I learned a lot. I made mistakes as an organizer, but we went through a lot of struggles, but it's been like the privilege of my life organizing.
I was going to ask you, you're a family man as well, as you said earlier. You're working class yourself, you're heavily involved in your DSA chapter. How do you kind of achieve that balance in your life? Like, how do these things kind of influence one another? I'm curious. You know, people talk about, you know, organizing should be for all kinds of people. And something we like, especially on our show, is to kind of not necessarily give advice, quote unquote, to, you know, anybody who's looking either to get into organizing or to, you know, maybe better refine their organizing. How do you kind of like balance that stuff out? I'm curious.
I would say it's not easy. I think that I believe that DSA, we need to be, I think accessibility, inclusiveness should be something that we should prioritize as an organization. And when I say that, like, I mean a lot about language justice, making sure that the people that speak other languages can be involved, that comrades of color can feel welcome. But that also, I think that I also wanted to talk about people who work full time. Like I work sometimes 40, 50 hours a week, 60 hours a week in the construction sites. We have parents that have to care for the children. So I think that as leaders of DSA, we have to find ways that everyone can feel welcome and feel that they can play a part in our organizing. So it's, to me right now, it's been difficult. I mean, I'll tell you this, between organizing and my full-time job, I have very few time for my family, for my daughter. I feel that, and again, I think it's about building capacity, right? I think it's building capacity. It's about using our time as organizers smart. And I think that all that comes with the structure. And I think that we have to build these structures to make the DSA more accessible for all kinds of workers. Because I think that if we don't include all kinds of workers in the work, we're not going to achieve socialism in our lifetime. So I think that we have to think about everyone when we do what we do.
Organize smarter, not harder, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Damn right.
But honestly, man, you're an inspiration, bro. Like, for real, for real.
Yeah. Shout out to my
parents. 1,000,000%. And once again, this is exactly. And once again, this is why I say I love you, buddy. This is why I am proud to be running for MPC alongside you, because like, we need more people from the working class in leadership, right? We need more people from an actual working class background who understand these struggles in leadership. I think that's critically important. And once again, I thank you so much for your time here. I don't know if either of you have any more questions, or we're already over an hour here. I don't know, Leroy, if you want to take us home here, but once again, dude, thank you. Thank you so much. I know I've learned a lot about you, and I feel like I know you pretty well, right? We've worked together for almost over a year now, and I learned a whole bunch about you that I never even knew. So thanks, man.
Yeah. I think my question is, how's your Spanish?
I know enough to on the construction sites. I think that when I learned the most, so during 1 year of my life, I was the only, me, my brother-in-law and my father, we worked together in this construction company, and we were the only Brazilians. Everybody else was Mexican or Ecuadorian. So I think that was the most Spanish exposure that I got in my life. And I think that I learned enough. I learned enough to be able to communicate in the job site, which helps me out a lot. I already had people laughing at me, seeing me talking in Spanish, because they're like, what kind of Spanish is that? But I think I can hold my own. So that's good enough.
For anyone listening to this, like, Spanish and Portuguese, specifically like Brazilian Portuguese, is fairly similar, I would say. There's a lot of things here and there are different, but the one biggest difference is intonation. So, like, as perfect as Fern's Spanish will ever be, he'll still have that Brazilian intonation. My Portuguese can be perfect, but I always have that Spanish intonation that we're always going to sound funny when we speak it. But nah, it's nothing but love here, man. But just to echo what the guy said, you know, it's been a pleasure having you here, talking about, I think, one of my favorite places in Latin America, historically speaking, politically speaking. Give us everybody insight, because I think the three of us here have a decent working knowledge, but it's invaluable for people who might not have that knowledge who will listen to us. So thank you for coming on, shedding light on all this stuff, and hopefully we'll have you on again. And obviously, good luck with the NPC and all your organizing endeavors. And good luck to Lula. Lula is going to win. But number one priority is to get Bolsonaro out. But with that said, again, if you support what we do here, Machete Mate, and want to show your solidarity and have access to Austin's recount of meeting the Red Pope, as he calls him, consider showing your solidarity on our Patreon and become un compo oficial. Thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned for a special announcement, special project coming your way. But with that said, hasta la victoria.
Peace.
Later, y'all.